I'll get my Bible to Proverbs chapter 13. I hope you'll go there in your Bible too. And I want to begin reading a couple of verses from that text. Proverbs chapter 13. Down in verse 13, the wise man says, "The one who despises the word will be in debt to it. But the one who hears the commandment will be rewarded. The teaching of the wise is a fountain of life to turn aside from the snares of death. Good understanding produces favor, but the way of the treacherous is hard." I met Ricky Blackmon in the spring of 1988. We didn't know each other at all. In fact, his father had arranged our first meeting. And so you know how that is when you're meeting someone for the first time. He and I sat down together and we began to share our stories. We began to talk about our lives. As we did that, it was interesting to me to discover that he and I were a lot alike. That our stories had some marked places of similarity. For example, like most of you, we all counted Texas as home. I grew up in the suburbs of Houston. Ricky had grown up in Mount Pleasant. We'd both grown up in church-going families. My family was one of the original families that started the Kleinwood Church in North Houston. His family had gone for years to the Southside Church in Mount Pleasant. In fact, our families were involved families. My dad at that time was an elder at the Kleinwood Church. His dad was involved in gospel preaching. There was a little group out a ways from Mount Pleasant in a little spot called Cooper's Chapel, Texas. That was actually the homestead for Ricky's family. They had lived on that piece of ground going back to the 1800s. And they saw an old frame church building there and a small group of mostly older people who would worship there on Sundays, mostly his family. And Ricky's dad went out and preached for them occasionally. And we'd both been taught to get involved in all of that very early. Brother Billy Goff was one of our song leaders at Kleinwood, and I won't tell the story, but when I was in junior high, he sort of tricked me to start leading songs, and that's how I got involved in. And that's how Ricky got involved in serving too, because when his dad would go out to Cooper's Chapel to preach, he persuaded Ricky to come along and he would do the preaching and Ricky would lead the singing for him. And so as we sort of told those stories, we found all these little places where our lives had really been a lot alike. And yet there we sat, just a few feet from each other in that first meeting, but I will tell you folks, we were miles apart. I was a 21-year-old kid just starting my life and starting my work as a gospel preacher for a little church in Huntsville, Texas. And there Ricky sat across from me, a 30-year-old capital murderer working through the legal process that was going to bring his life to an end. The irony has never been lost on me. How does that happen? How did two people from such similar backgrounds end up in so two radically different places? Michael Grachik, a reporter for the Associated Press who interviewed Ricky not long before he died, it wasn't lost on him either. He asked him, "How does someone like you end up in a place like this?" I don't know that the answer to that question is uncomplicated, but I can tell you that Ricky and I talked about it a lot. And when he answered the question, he always began at the same place and explained it in the same way. He would say, "I need to go back to the time that I was in high school, a freshman, 15 years old, and I started hanging out with the wrong crowd. I started associating with the wrong people." For him, that was where his life pivoted and everything turned. There were consequences that came with that choice because he was with that crowd. Immediately he began to get to get pressure to do things. His whole life he had been taught were wrong. He began to smoke cigarettes and drink and then use drugs and have sex. All the things he knew he shouldn't do, but the crowd was doing. And if he was going to be with the crowd, well, he had to go along. In fact, in one of the letters he exchanged with me, he said this. He said, "Before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. I'm talking about sex, dope, and drinking, and thinking my parents didn't know what they were talking about, telling me not to do this or that. And I didn't like someone telling me how to run my life." But he says, as I look back on it now, my friends were running my life, but I was having fun the way they did. And it seemed I had control, but as I look back on it now, I see that I was wrong. I hope that you are as disturbed about that as I always have been. Here's a 30-year-old disciple who's committed murder and condemned to die. And if you ask him, where did it all go wrong? He says, when I was 15 years old and chose to run with the wrong crowd. For that was the moment where his life pivoted to the other path. Ignoring the warning of his parents, Ricky continued to run with that crowd into his adult life. In his 20s, he used and abused every kind of drug, though marijuana became his drug of choice. He was sexually immoral. He surrounded himself with the worst kinds of people. He couldn't hold down a job. In fact, he described for me not long before he died what was sort of the cycle of his life during his 20s. He said, I'd go find some job doing something, and I would save every dime I didn't have to have to live. And when I had a little bit set aside, I'd quit and I'd go party. You understand we're not talking about cake and ice cream, right? And he would spend all of his money up using drugs and partying with his friends. And when he was broke and the money was gone, he'd go get a job doing something else. And so that was the cycle that he lived over and over again for a decade, all through his 20s. It would not be until the spring of 1987 that Ricky would discover just how far this path would take him and how terribly destructive it would prove to be. In March of that year, he was on the downside of the cycle. Things were so bad, he was living at the state park in a tent or sleeping in his car when it got too cold. And worse, he was out of money to support his drug habit. But he was with a woman who said she knew how they could get some quick money to buy drugs, because she knew a guy back in her hometown of Haslam that owned a grocery store and who always carried money on him. And so they planned to rob him. And the robbery didn't go as planned, and that young 22-year-old grocery store owner was killed. It did not take long to figure out who had done this and to run down Ricky and his accomplice. And it did not take long for a jury that next November to find him guilty. There was no question about that. He was convicted of capital murder and condemned to die and sent to the Ellis Unit in Huntsville, Texas, where he would spend 11 years waiting for the wheels of justice to grind to their inevitable end. And it would be there at the Ellis Unit in Huntsville that this condemned murderer and this young preacher would cross paths for a few years. I would go out and study with him once a week while I lived there. And then I moved away to Chicago and then Orlando. I visited him occasionally, but mostly we exchanged letters, lots and lots of letters. I have a whole file of them. But the one that I remember most is the last one that I received in July of 1999. It read, "Dear David and family, how are you? Fine, I hope and pray. Myself, I am very nervous. I am in touch with the Lord this day more so than I have ever been. My heart feels like I can't get it to pump enough blood, and my hand feels like it wants to start shaking, but I'm holding fast to the word of the Lord. Just today I was informed of my execution date. I will go to be with the saints that are awaiting for the day of judgment on August 4th, 1999. Well, brother, I'm sorry this letter is short, but I have much people to tell this to. So take care and remain strong as I am trying to do. God bless you. Love, Ricky Dunn. On August 4th, 1999, a Wednesday evening, the state of Texas executed Ricky for the murder of Carl Wrinkle. Oddly enough, he was buried by that little church in Cooper's Chapel. I got to go spend some time with him about 3 days before his execution and to be with him when he died. We talked about a lot of stuff, as you can kind of imagine for a man who knows he's going to die in 3 days. But as we sat there in that little visiting room and talked over those 3 days, it was interesting that our conversations kept coming around to the same subject. It was how much he hoped people would learn from his mistakes. He had a special passion for young people. You can see why, can't you? Because he just thought so many of his troubles began in his youth and the choices that he made. And I guess he just hoped that if they could hear his story, that maybe they would make different choices from the ones that he made. And so as I've reflected on all the time that he and I sat and visited through that little window, it has occurred to me that I've heard him preach a lot of sermons that he will never preach in a church anywhere. And so, true confession time. I'm going to use some borrowed material for this sermon. I want to preach a few of his sermons for him. And to say to you some things that I think that if he could stand here, he would want to say to you. And I do that first and primarily because I think he would say some things that God wants us to know. And if you'll let me do that today, it will help me keep a promise to a friend that his story would be told. And that perhaps from the tragedy that was his life, maybe some good thing might come. So, that's the story. If he could stand here today and speak to you, what would Ricky Blackmon say? Well, let me start with this. If he could speak to us, I think the first thing that he would want to say, and frankly, the sermon that I heard from him most frequently, I think he would want to say is, your crowd matters. That makes sense that he would say that, doesn't it? I suppose that he talked to me most frequently about that because in his mind, that's where his troubles began. In fact, he wrote in one of his letters, he said, I was baptized at 15 years old and I helped my dad by leading singing every Sunday. As I got older, I started to have friends that were not Christians, and some of the things they did were fun. Some of the things I did not want to do, but my friends would say, come on, it won't hurt you, or what's the matter, are you scared? And after a while, I thought it was okay. I started smoking cigarettes because my friends did, and I started drinking because they did. And when I was in the ninth grade, I was introduced to smoking dope because my friends said, oh, you'll like it. And I did. Before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. That bothers me. It haunts me. That a man in his 30s facing such a disaster would look back to what seems to be such a simple thing at such a young age and say, this is how it all happened. It's about a choice I made at 15, a choice I made about the people I chose to be close to, about my friends. What's the lesson? Your crowd matters. But I told you, God is way ahead of Ricky on this. And so back in the book of Proverbs, back up to chapter 1, because I think this book opens with a powerful statement about that. And I want to read a sizable piece of this chapter. I want you to follow along with me. Listen to what he says. This is Proverbs 1. I'm starting down in verse number 8. Are you there in your Bible? Listen to this. This is Proverbs 1, verse 8. The wise man says, "My son, hear your father's instruction and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck." We'll come back to those two in a minute. But then look at verse 10. "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us,' let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit. We will find all kinds of precious wealth. We will fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us, and we will have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. And indeed, it is useless to spread the baited net in the sight of any bird. But they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessor." I see Ricky in those verses. Verse 10 says, if sinners entice, do not consent. Verse 15, do not walk in the way with them. Why? Verse 18, they ambush their own lives. You realize that is exactly what Ricky did? If you want to boil it all down to its most basic level, he consented to walk with the sinners, to walk in their path, and he ambushed his life. John would describe people in his own day in John 12 and verse 42 who had heard Jesus, considered Jesus, witnessed his miracles, and concluded he was the Son of God. But the text goes on with this bizarre next step. They would not confess him, even though they knew. Why? Because the crowd wouldn't approve. Verse 43 says they loved the approval of men more than the approval of God. We look at that and we think how foolish that is. But the truth is, every single time, brothers and sisters, we let a wicked influence around us pull us into something that Christ doesn't want us to do. We are doing exactly the same thing, choosing the crowd over the Christ. We get started doing that, we are headed for trouble. I think if Ricky could speak to us, he would want to say, don't make that mistake. I think he would want to say, surround yourself with better people because the crowd matters. I have been doing a little informal research. I've been talking to young people who grew up among us and then when they got out of the home fell away for a time and then they came back to the Lord. And I've been asking them, what happened? How'd you get off the path? And I want you to know that every person I have talked to about that has told me that the crowd played a significant role in getting them off in the wrong direction. I just had the wrong kinds of friends. I associated with the wrong kinds of people. I hear that again and again and again. And I know you've heard it before too. Young people sitting in this crowd, I know you've heard it from preachers and mom and dad and from Bible class teachers. I just think Ricky thought that if you could hear it from him, coming from his situation, maybe it might help you realize how truly profound the consequences can be when you choose the wrong crowd. If he could speak today, he would want to say, the crowd matters. Let me give you a second thing. If he could speak today, he would want to say, secondly, that parents matter. I mention that because some of my most moving conversations with him were about his mom and dad. He loved his parents. He hated that he was able to spend so little time with them. They lived way up in Oklahoma, came and visited as much as they could. But listen, they were older and it was a long drive down there. And even coming as much as they could, it was never enough. He wanted to see them more. He wanted to have some contact with them. It frustrated him that he could never hug his mother when she came to visit. Once a guy goes into the death row system, there's no contact with the outside world. again. His hardest moment during that 11 years was 1993 when his dad died unexpectedly of a heart attack. And he could not go and comfort his mother like a son is supposed to. And nobody could be there to comfort him. And as the time drew near for him to be executed, he worried about his mother and how this would all affect her. She was not in good health, and it was a terrible burden for him to bear. He loved his mom and dad. We talked about that all the time. But I need to tell you that for a good period of life, he did not value them. Remember, his parents were church-going folks. They were disciples. And so they didn't just kind of sit on the sidelines and watched as their son went off the cliff. Everything he did over their protest. In fact, in one of his letters he wrote to me, it said, "Daddy kept trying to tell me, you're going to make a mess of things if you keep living like you are, but I didn't think so," he said. I still remember him telling me about that part of the story in his very first visit with me. I watched the tears well up in his eyes and roll down his cheeks as he gritted his teeth and said, "David, I wish I had listened to my dad." Parents matter. And God was way ahead of him on that. God said that a long time ago. He charges parents with a sacred duty, Ephesians 6:4, to bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. I want to tell young people in the audience this morning, I want to let you in on a secret your parents have been keeping from you, okay? Hear me on this. You need to know that after they send you to bed at night, your mom and dad, they go back in their room, but they don't go to sleep. They close the door, and they sit up sometimes late into the night talking about you, just trying to figure out what they can do tomorrow to make your life more miserable. Do you realize that? And if for a second you thought that was true, you're probably wrong about a lot of stuff. Moms and dads do go back in their room some nights and close the door and sit up and talk about their kids, but I'm going to tell you, it ain't about making their life more miserable. We're just trying to figure out how to get this right, aren't we? And we don't always do that. And that's okay, because you mess up being a kid too. It's just an imperfect arrangement. But the great thing about every parent and grandparent sitting in this crowd is what we want to do, what we're trying to do, is to get it right, to bring up our kids the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So, in Ephesians 6, backing up three verses, Paul would talk about, God through Paul talks about a child's response to that. What does he say? "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth." Remember back in Proverbs 1, the part I passed over, verses 8 and 9, and said we'd get back to. Remember what he says, listen to your father's instruction and don't ignore the teaching of your mother. We say a lot about that obedience part. We do not say enough about the honor part in verse 2. It is the higher level. It literally carries the idea of valuing what mom and dad say. I tell young people all the time, if you have been determined to do something, and if it's never happened that you changed your mind because of what your mom and dad say, you probably don't honor them. Because that's what it means to attach great value to them and what they say. Don't make the mistake Ricky did. Don't ignore the wise counsel of your mom and dad. And ends up in some terrible mess looking back on your life and saying what he said with tears in his eyes, "I had wished I had listened to my mom and dad." Parents matter. And finally, last thing I want to say to you that I think he would say to you is sin matters. I want you to understand that Ricky never imagined that his life would end up like it did. He never imagined that early in his teen years, those first seemingly small steps in the wrong direction would take him so far down that path and he would end up where he did. He told me one time about the first time they brought him to the state prison and brought him to his cell. And he said, I listened to those big heavy iron doors slam shut behind me. And he said, I buried my head in my hands and sat on my bunk and began to sob. And he said, I just thought to myself, how did I ever get here? This wasn't the plan. He never dreamed it would all cost so much. And I want you to understand that for a good period of his life, his wicked choices didn't seem to be costing him at all. Remember that throughout his 20s, for a decade, he ran around with the worst people. He used drugs. He was sexually immoral. He basically lived a terribly wicked life and didn't seem any worse for the wear, except for those times when he had to sleep in his car on the downside of the cycle. You get by that. He was doing okay. One night, when all of the choices, the crowd, the drugs, the sexual immorality, one night when all of those things kind of collided together in the wrong set of circumstances, and now he's paid a terrible price. So it was interesting to me to talk to Ricky about what was hard about prison life. I had some presuppositions about that. I always thought the worst thing about being in prison is not knowing if the guy sleeping in the bunk next to you would cut your throat in the middle of the night. Never talked about threats to his physical safety. He complained all the time about not being able to hug his mother. Frustrated him that he never got to partake of the Lord's Supper. He missed that. Made me appreciate my privilege of a weekly observance. He talked about the embarrassment he brought to his family. He said sometimes people would ask his mom, whatever happened to Ricky? Well, he never comes around anymore. How does a mother of a murderer answer a question like that? He talked about living with a death sentence. Every day. First thought in the morning. Last thought before he would drift off into sleep. And then there was that last month. And then those last 3 days. And then being with him those last minutes before his life was taken. I've never seen anybody experiencing something so awful. I don't say that to make you feel sorry for Ricky. I don't want you to feel sorry for Ricky. If you want to grieve for somebody, please grieve for Carl's mother. She's a good lady and she suffered terribly. I'll tell you the truth about Ricky, folks. He paid the price that he deserved to pay for the crime that he committed. But here's the point. He never saw that coming. He never imagined that it would all end up this way. And so if he could speak to us, what he would want to say is that sin matters. And listen, God's way ahead of him on that point. God has been trying to tell us. And so I'm back in Proverbs 1 again. Remember the warning? It's interesting that beginning at verse 11, the crowd promises all these great things that this young man will enjoy if he will just throw in his lot with them. Hey, we're going to be really rich. We're going to have all this stuff. We won't have to work for it. And in verse 18, we're reminded that's not how it turns out in the end. So people who follow that path ambush their own lives. You know, that's a problem as old as Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That's been the way the devil has operated from the beginning. Think about it. Hey, Eve, you're going to be like God, knowing good and evil. He's holding out on you. This is really going to be great. Yeah, it turned out really great, didn't it? The rain got here. Feeling real good about the change of venue on the potluck right now, right? Me too. You know, the first psalm, Psalm 1, is the perfect introductory psalm because it describes the two paths and their outcome. And so in verses 1 through 3, after describing how the righteous man thrives, in verse 4 he says, the wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor the sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. You know what our problem is? We think we can dabble in sin just a little bit and not get hurt, only to suddenly be swallowed up in his trap. You know, David thought that too. That ugly episode in 2 Samuel 11, what a simple mistake. I sympathize with David. I understand how a man makes the mistake David made. He saw a woman unclothed, an attractive woman. What was his mistake? What was his sin? Let's be clear. He looked too long. Can you see how a man would make that mistake? And yet, who would have thought that from the look would come lust? Well, that made sense. But then adultery, and then all that awful stuff where he's trying to cover up his crime and hide what he's done and deceive her husband. And when that doesn't work, in desperation, people are going to find out he has him murdered. Who would have thought? If it was a plot to a movie, people would think, well, it's kind of stretching it a little. There are no thoughts of murder that night on the rooftop in Jerusalem. No one would have imagined that it would all come to that, and that is exactly what it came to. Folks, that's how sin is. You know the old saying about it. It takes us further than we plan to go, costs us more than we ever think we're going to pay. We're living at a time where the mantra of our culture is sin is no big deal. It is a lie of the devil. It is not true. It is a big deal. The way of the transgressor is hard. Sin matters. Which is why God, in his grace and mercy, has done something to rescue us. That's what's being celebrated in the passage we talked about in Bible class, Ephesians chapter 2. All of us are living with a death sentence, folks. Because of our sin, we are condemned to the second death, separation from God for now and forever. And yet, through Christ, God has provided a reprieve for us. And what he says is, bring me your broken life, and I will give you peace. If you want that this morning, we want to help you. You can let us know your desire by making your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing.